Hello, this is Sunday Profile, Richard Addy with you. Today, very deliberately, we're going to slow things down. Carl Honoré is a writer with one subject, slow. The slow movement is a reaction against the tendency of modern wealthy economies to embrace speed, to do everything faster. Slow began in Italy with a protest against the opening of a fast food franchise. It moved into kitchens where some things just can't be hurried, leading to slow food. And gradually, it would have to be gradually, it became a wider movement about taking one's time. Carl Honoré explores this in his writing. But he doesn't just chronicle what's going on, he advocates too. He's written about slow parenting and slow decision-making, the very opposite of what so often tempts us when confronted with a problem, a quick fix. So, what is the essence of slow?
Well, slow is not doing everything as slowly as possible. I mean, I'm not an extremist of slowness. I love speed. The slow philosophy or the slow revolution is about doing things at the right speed. So understanding that there are times to be fast and times to be slow, what musicians call the tempo giusto, the idea that each piece of music has a natural rhythm. You get as close to that rhythm as possible, and whatever you're doing, you're going to do it better and enjoy it more.
I suppose the thing that people would be more aware of is this idea of slow food. Did the slow movement come out of slow food, or?
Well, I actually think that the deep roots of the slow movement go further back. I mean, if you go to the 19th century, you find the Transcendentalists, you find the arts and crafts movement in England, you find lots of people raising the flag for the notion that slowness has a role to play. So this goes way back. But I suppose what slow food did, starting in Italy in the late 80s and early 90s, was to take back that word slow, which has become such a pejorative in our fast-forward culture, and turn it around and say, actually, slow is good. Slow has a role to play, and we're slow and we're proud of it. So since slow food came along, now, of course, you have every imaginable form of slow, good slow, in the sense of slow design, slow architecture, slow sex, slow parenting, slow management. You know, wherever you go, people are hanging this
really
word
it's,
on
it's that big. I was aware of slow food and I suppose the slow movement and slow parenting, which is something you've written about before, but I had no idea it was as broad as you say.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a real culture quake, and it's right across the whole of the spectrum of human activity. Whatever people are doing, there will be some people in that arena embracing the idea that faster isn't always better. And so they're often doing it under the umbrella of the term slow. So just recently, for instance, I heard from a housemaster at Eton College, the famous prestigious private school in England that's churned out 21 prime ministers, including David Cameron. And he said to me, we need to join forces to launch a slow education movement. And I thought, goodness me, I mean, Eton is a machine for type A, high-achieving, you know, hard-driving kids. And he said, well, you know, if that's the gold standard is wrong because our children are burning out. They're not learning properly. They're not enjoying things. And we need to reconnect with our inner tortoise. So wherever you look around the world now, people are using that English word slow, even outside the Anglosphere, using it as a shorthand for a better, more balanced way of doing absolutely everything.
It's clearly a growing movement. Are there still places where it's seen as an insult to be slow on something? And obviously, you can't be slow when you're playing most kinds of sport, for example.
Sure, you know, I mean, I'm an ice hockey player, and you've got to be pretty quick to hold your own on a rink. You know, the idea is that there's good slow and bad slow. And if you do good slow, then people will respond, they'll understand. And I think now, I mean, my first book, In Praise of Slow, came out in 2004, which is 9 years ago. And certainly I had a feeling then when I came out that I was a voice in the wilderness and that I had to explain what this slow culture quake was, what it meant. I wasn't defending doing things in slow motion, that I was all about doing things at the right speed. Now I don't ever have to have that conversation anymore. People come to me and say, so what's new in the slow movement? Or, you know what, I heard that there's a slow design cooperative opening up in Vietnam, and you realize how wide and deep this goes now, that it's something I think is pretty firmly on the cultural international radar.
I have to ask, actually, slow design. Well, surely all design is slow design, unless you want things to fall down.
Well, exactly, but this is part of the problem now, is that even designers, even people who, by the very nature of their job, should be slow, find themselves under immense pressure to churn stuff out faster and faster, and they end up skimming the surface, they end up cutting corners, and you end up, oh, well, just look at what happened at Toyota. You know, Toyota is a classic example. It rose right to the top of the car-making world, and then it got too fast. It stopped looking at problems, it stopped designing things well, and then we saw how that ended, didn't we? I mean, a couple of years ago, it was, what, 10 million cars recalled and a $2 billion bill, lawsuits up to their eyeballs, and that was because their designers, their manufacturers, they just forgot how to put the brakes on. They got too quick for their own good.
You are kind of pushing at an open door now, aren't you? I mean, maybe 2004, it was this kind of idea most people hadn't heard of. Now, there is a movement and people are open to the idea.
Oh, completely. And of course, 2004 is pre-financial crisis.
Yeah.
And I think that moved the tectonic plates even more, because that underscored that, you know, money got too fast. The financial system was moving too quickly. The people inside it had no time to pull apart these credit default swaps or collateralized debt obligations, work out whether they were worth the paper they were written on. It was all about fast profit.
Well, that hasn't changed in a way, because with the algorithmic trading, essentially now people paying 2 seconds to get key indicator numbers in America before they go out on the public news wires. And in that 2 seconds, so many trades can be done. So we're not moving towards slow finance, are we?
No, well, there is actually a slow finance movement. In fact, interestingly, one of the big heavyweights in the investment world in London, the City of London, published a book about a year and a half ago called Slow Finance. And I think that if he'd published that 4 or 5 years ago, he would have been laughed out of town, or there'd have been blood on the floor. But on the contrary, now people are open to the idea that that kind of short-term beggar thy neighbor approach to capitalism is not really that useful. Of course, as you say, the high-speed trading is part of it. But even in the high-speed trading world, the high-frequency trading, they're discovering that even there, speed enters the diminishing return stage. In other words, if you get too fast, you start making more mistakes. So some of these high-frequency systems are now building in a bit of slowness. So they're building in delays. They're moving further away. Yeah, so it shows.
I've seen it represented before as a kind of Darwinian arms race. You know, if you've got to pay the money to get the information 2 seconds before the public does, because all of your competitors are going to do that. And in that time, they can institute all of these trades faster than you or I could think of them. And everybody can see there's a problem, but nobody knows how to get off.
No, exactly. But I mean, in a way, that's interesting you bring up Darwin, because really, Darwin was not about the survival of the fastest. It was the survival of the fittest. And I guess that's what the essence of this slow philosophy is that you're a lot smarter, you're a lot healthier, you're a lot happier, you're a lot fitter if you're going at the right speed, as opposed to going in roadrunner mode at every turn.
How did we do that? How do we conflate these two things? Because we have, and many people still do. We will find ourselves oohing and aahing over what technology has given us in terms of smartphones and the internet and everything, and then being astonished at the price that we have to pay for being hooked up all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm oohing and aahing along with everyone else. I have all the Apple gear, and I love Wi-Fi, and I want my phone to be as fast as possible. I mean, it's not surprising that we are seduced by speed. Speed is a bit like a drug. It's an adrenaline rush, and it gives us a thrill. And it gives us the illusion of doing things, of achieving things. And so that's a very appealing thing to have. So you get stuck in that mode of just wanting to cram more and more in and go faster and faster. But I think ultimately when people do find themselves stopping or slowing down and reflecting, often it's their health that gives in. You know, the body just says, I can't take the pace anymore, and you have a burnout or a heart attack. When that slowness is imposed and you're forced to take a look at the big picture and look hard at how you are living and what you're doing, you begin to realize that full speed ahead turbocharged existence is ultimately unfulfilling and pointless. It's great to have speed some of the time, but if you don't shift gears, if you don't reconnect with your inner tortoise from time to time, then it's going to blow up in your face.
If you look at it in those sort of Darwinian evolutionary biological terms, you can see why we do it. You can see why we seek the quick fix and being able to respond quickly. And I think you've written this yourself, there's no point in trying to work out the slow way to get away from the line if the line catches your eye the other side of the watering hole. You have to just go.
Exactly. And that's a very useful reflex to have, of course, even though we're not many lions around in these days. But, you know, we still have the same brains that we had on the savannah in Africa all those centuries ago. And in those days, there was no incentive to sit back, stroke your chin, and take the long Aristotelian view. It was about how to survive, how to get through each problem now, today. And that's still useful, even in the modern world. But if that's the only gear you have, is the quick fix, is the superficial instant reaction, then you're going to be in trouble, because so many of the problems we can confront nowadays are immensely complex, tangled, nuanced. They might even be impossible to solve. And to get into them, to start unpacking them and start forging solutions that actually work, takes slowness. It takes time. It takes the ability to sit with uncertainty. You know, we find it very hard now in this management consultant-driven culture where we want to plot everything on a graph and boil everything down to a PowerPoint slide. We want to show me the numbers. That's the phrase that we're always shouting at each other. But so many of these difficult problems, such as world poverty or climate change or sorting out social reform in Australia, these things, you can't plot them on a graph. Nobody is ever going to write an algorithm that solves these difficult problems. They're going to take that kind of slightly messy, slightly muddled, slightly slow approach that is ultimately very human.
On Sunday Profile, I'm Richard Adie, and today my guest is Carl Honoré, who's a writer and speaker and has become a bit of an evangelist with a very receptive audience for the slow movement, for taking things, for getting things to take the appropriate amount of time. I was thinking, Carl, one of the things that you've written about is slow parenting. Now, it takes a bit of getting your head around because, of course, parenting's a slow job. It starts before birth and then at birth, and you have children around you for a long time now. And yet you identified a need for spelling this out more explicitly.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that the virus of hurry has infected our approach to raising children, so that nowadays we've turned parenting into a cross between a competitive sport and product development. We feel as parents, and I'm a parent myself, I'm on the front line here, I know how this works. It starts from a noble and natural instinct, which is the instinct to do the best for your children. But over the last generation, that has morphed into a caricature of itself, so that now as parents, we feel under immense pressure to push, polish, and protect our children with superhuman zeal, to give them the best of everything, and at the same time, make them the best at everything. And I think for a lot of kids, it's turned childhood into an endless race to perfection.
Actually, you tell a story about this, how you kind of got seduced as a parent by one particular word with your son a few years ago now.
Yes, I remember. I remember it with a wince even now. Well, I realized that I had got infected by this hyper-parenting bug at a parent-teacher evening. And you may recognize the scenario. I was perched on one of those low plastic seats in the primary school, looking up at the teacher, just waiting for her to drop a pearl of praise into my lap. And this was for my 7-year-old son. The feedback was very good, but it was nothing stellar to make you punch the air until I went to the art room and the art teacher was just falling over herself with praise. And of course, inside, I'm getting terribly excited, right, as a hyper-parent. And then she dropped what I think of as the G-bomb. She said, "Mr. Honoré, your son is a gifted young artist." And there it was, that six-letter word, which I think for a lot of modern parents it's like the Holy Grail. It's a red rag to a bull. And suddenly I didn't hear anything else. All I could see was my son's name, Benjamin Honoré, gifted up in neon. And I did what I think a lot of parents would do in those circumstances. I ran home and I hopped on Google, started looking for an art teacher or a painting clinic or some kind of tutor who could take this gift and polish it up so the whole world would see it shine. And I found one who just lived around the corner from us in London. I went to bed that night convinced that the next Picasso was sleeping downstairs. Got up in the morning and my son said on the way to school, when I said, "I found you this art tutor," he said, "What? I don't want a tutor. I just want to draw." And then he asked me the question that I think of as the coup de grace, and it was really the starting point for writing my book, Under Pressure. He said to me, "Why do grown-ups always have to take over everything?" And it was one of those questions that hit us as parents, like in the solar plexus. And I just suddenly thought, it was a moment of searing epiphany where you see yourself in sharp relief from the side. And what I saw there was very unedifying. And I thought, here I am, the author of a book called In Praise of Slow, which is about letting things happen, taking your time. And I'm trying to accelerate my son's artistic development to turn him into Rembrandt by next week. And I just thought, no, this is crazy. And that for me was the wake-up call, light bulb over the moment.
We'll come back to the whole slow and personal relationships, because there's more to talk on about that. But you've been in Australia and you've done a couple of workshops with education policymakers and people involved in childcare, after-school childcare. What are they interested in terms of slow?
Well, I've spoke at one conference to workers from OOSH, the out of, how does that one work? School hour, the kind of play.
Out of school hours care.
There it is, right. And they, of course, they're on the cutting edge here. They're feeling a lot of the pressure to accelerate, to measure everything, to tick boxes. They're getting the pressure from the government in the form of regulations, and they're getting a lot of pressure from parents who regard free play, the kind of thing that actually builds children's brains, a million times better than Kumon tutoring and educational DVDs, just messing around, letting their imagination run wild, looking at ladybirds and giving them names and building stories around them. They see that and they think that sounds like a waste of time. You can't put a ladybird moment on a resume. So we need them sitting down and doing their handwriting. And so there's pressure from parents as well. So I found these workers were desperate to get their head around was to hear the examples from around the world where people are pushing back against this product development approach to child rearing and backing off, getting parents out of the way, getting adults out of the way, and letting children be children, play, get bored. We're all terrified of boredom nowadays. You let a kid get bored, he'll fall through it, she'll fall through it, and start to invent, think creatively, learn how to get on with their peers, and look into themselves and work out who they are, rather than what we want them to be. So it's interesting to see that even here in Australia, which has, of course, a reputation as being terribly laid back, right? You know that virus of hurry and all of that hyper-parenting anxiety and angst is running through people's bloodstreams here clearly as well.
And another thing that we've picked up from other parts of the world, including North America, but the UK too, is we now have more and more national testing. And this has been about raising standards. But of course, it means that teachers and schools act rationally, which is teach to the test. How can you, I suppose, get input to the education policymakers to ask them to get a bit slower?
Well, one thing is to show them other examples of countries that are thriving by not teaching to the test. So the example that is always trotted out is Finland, which is held up as an avatar of low pressure, untested education, where Finnish children enter schooling in the year in which they turn seven, spend fewer hours in the classroom, less homework. There's no private tutoring industry really to speak of in Finland, and they do very few, almost no standardized tests. Yet, when it comes time for Finnish pupils to sit down at the age of 15 and compete in the international OECD PISA exams, they come routinely number one and number two in every subject, right? So you have this delicious paradox of slow, that by slowing down, by getting adults out of the way, by backing off, by letting children become protagonists of their own learning, giving them the space to reflect and process what they've learned, they will hit it for six, as you say. They will knock the ball out of the park.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're hardwired to do. They're thirsty. Their brains are like sponges. If we would just back off and allow that to happen, that's when the real intellectual and cerebral fireworks can happen. And these are the kinds of things you've got to take to policymakers in Australia and say, look, this notion of testing and testing over and over again until marks become more important than learning itself is already a bankrupt system. It's not working in other countries. And even if you look across the water to the Chinese world, people often say, oh, we can't slow down. We can't ease off the pressure because we will be trampled into the dust by a stampeding herd of uber-competitive tiger mums, right?
That's it.
Exactly. That's the fear everybody's got. But you look across the water, and 10 months ago, the Prime Minister of Singapore stood up on National Day and took the parents of that island state to task. He said, we have lost our compass. We have lost our bearings as parents by driving our children with all of this pressure, testing over and over again, overscheduling up to the eyeballs. We are raising a generation of narrow and neurotic children, exam-passing robots. It's time for children to get bored, to play, to learn through play. All the stuff that I'm saying and that other people are saying that Finland is proving is at the end. This is the Prime Minister of Singapore, the spiritual home of the tiger mom, standing up and saying, dial it down. Less pressure, slow things down a little bit. And what are we doing in the Anglo-Saxon world? We're just dialing it right up again. So there's this weird disconnect between the reality of what science is telling us and what other countries are experiencing and what we're actually doing with our policy and our schools.
Do you have a personal disconnect in that? You talk about slow, you write about slow, and you now travel a lot to give workshops. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if your own life is not slow, and if your own kids might say, Dad, we saw a bit more of you before you got all slow on us.
There's always a danger of that, and people do often ask that question. But I tell you, I do travel, but I don't travel that much, and I say no all the time to things. I pick the things that I think are the most important to do, and I travel, and I travel slowly. I don't overburden myself on the trips. I make sure I'm spacing things out. I have time to speak and recharge and so on. And then when I'm home, I'm home. I'm home for weeks, ages at a time. And when I'm home, I'm there every breakfast. I look after the children one or two days a week after school. I walk them to school. I'm there to read bedtime stories. So I'm kind of there the rest of the time. And nowadays, my children are a bit older, so they're on social media and we're able to keep in touch in the times that I am away. I've just got my daughter has just got WhatsApp, so she's constantly WhatsApping me. And we do, video talks and stuff. So, I feel that I've got the right balance in my own life. I'm walking the talk. I'm not the opposite of what I'm preaching, if you like.
You used to be a journalist, and I suppose you still are. Your beat is narrowed to this one thing. How did you get drawn to the subject, though?
Well, I think that I had just got stuck in fast forward as a journalist and as a person. I was, every moment of my day was a race against the clock. And the wake up call for me came, really it was a personal thing. It was reading bedtime stories to my son at the time. And I just found that I could not slow down. So I'd be speed reading Snow White, skipping paragraphs, pages. And I became an expert. I gave it a name. I called it the multiple page turn technique.
Yeah.
And any parent listening knows exactly what I mean. But it never works. And I just got to a point where I found myself flirting with buying a book I'd heard about called The 1 Minute Bedtime Story. So they'd taken Snow White and boiled it down to 60 seconds. And I remember thinking, what a great idea. You know, I need to get that tomorrow from Amazon.
Just missing the point entirely, yeah, though.
Totally. But it was another light bulb overhead moment. I thought, am I really in such a hurry that I'm prepared to fob off my son with a soundbite at the end of the day? And that was the moment I suddenly thought, no, I just, and that was in a way where it all started for me. Thankfully, it started there, because for a lot of people, it starts with a heart attack or a relationship just blows up in your face because you haven't had the time to listen to the other person and be with them.
That's what I've been thinking since I've been talking to you. I was about to say, well, what's the next project? But I'm wondering if maybe it's something about the slow marriage. You know, when, if we look at our terrible marriage statistics around the Western world, you know, 40% and up of marriages fail in Australia. And I think it's worse in the United States. Mm. Perhaps we should all be thinking about the slow relationship.
Yeah. Certainly relationships are something that suffer, I think, greatly in this roadrunner culture. There are certain things you cannot accelerate. And one of those things is human relationships. These things have a natural arc and rhythm to them. And there's a terrible paradox at the moment that we're more connected than ever before, thanks to our gadgets. But I think in a lot of ways we're more alone. We've debased the currency of human relationships. We have 921 friends on Facebook, but what does that even mean? You know, when was the last time we actually spent a whole afternoon chatting face-to-face with one of those people in the park? And a lot of it comes down to the misuse of the gadgets. I love the technology, but it gets in the way. You know, it gets in the way of relationships. I think if you can use it to solidify relationships, but if you overuse it, you find that it starts to become a problem and a handicap, and it hampers. So, for instance, there's some statistics came out recently showing that about 20% of us now interrupt lovemaking to answer the phone or read an email. You know, when a society reaches a point where people can't even make love without getting distracted and having to keep their social media, just ridiculous. Or they've also discovered that when two people sit together face-to-face in a conversation in the real world and there's a phone on the table between them, doesn't have to go off, doesn't have to vibrate, doesn't even have to be visible to the screen, those two people at the end of that meeting feel less close to one another, less bonded. And that's the same employee, boss, parent, child, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, boyfriend, boyfriend, you know, whatever. Why is it? Because the possibility of distraction is enough to take us out of the moment. And this is what slowing down ultimately is about. It's about being in the moment. And nowadays we're so tempted to be in several moments at once that we end up putting quantity before quality. So a simple thing that anyone can do to just to enhance that basic relationship with whoever you're with is, if there's a phone on the table, put it in your pocket, you know, just a small, easy win that's right there for everyone, you know, and start to think about being present. I think being in the moment with the relationships, because ultimately, if you think of the big picture, no one lies on their deathbed and looks back and thinks, I wish I'd spent more time online or in the office. You know, what we look back on are the human moments, that long lunch you had in the garden with your grandmother the week before she died, the jokes you shared with your children in the park, those long moments lounging in bed on a Sunday morning with your partner, with the newspapers. These are the things that give a human life texture, color, and meaning, and they require slowness. You cannot accelerate them. You need to live them, and you can only live them one way, and that's slowly.
Good place to wrap up. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Carl Honoré writes, speaks, and consults on slow. You'll find more information on him on our website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational. And while you're there, let us know what you think about slow. Belinda Sommers, the program's producer. I'm Richard Adie. Thanks for listening.